Welcome back to Dating Games, the Modern Relationships podcast. I'm your host, Bobby Temps, and our guest this week is an internationally award-winning comedian, writer, and podcaster, who you may know from The Comedian's Comedian or Child Labour, which I realise slightly said out loud sounds like it's about literal child labour, but it's actually about parenting. And he hosts that with another upcoming guest here on Dating Games called Sindhu Fee. It's a brilliant show I love as someone who hopes to one day parent myself. I'm realising, God, you can tell that I was in a hurry today. Parent myself, something I do a lot for my mental health. What I mean there is be a parent one day to somebody else. So, to talk about parenting, relationships, so much more, it's Stuart Goldsmith.
Hey, thanks for having me. I balk at writer. I'm not much of a writer, certainly not in the last year. I haven't put pen to paper, but I am guilty as charged on the other things. And thank you. It was a joy to watch someone realise the joke in Child Labour, the title, as they were reading it out.
I think that's the thing, though. Sometimes when you're consuming it on your own, as you so often are with podcasting, yeah, you have such a distinct relationship to it.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
And then you say the title out loud. Like, one of my favourite podcasts is called Guys We Fucked.
that's a wonderful example of what you're talking about.
Yeah, totally. And I don't know if it's a reflection on like me being a male or what it is, but they assume it's men talking about fucking other men. So then I have to find a way of like being like, no, I don't mind if you assume it's that, but I'm like, oh, it's hosted by two comedians, Christina and Curran, two female men. Like, it's this weird thing where as soon as you get it out of your head as a podcast you listen to and try explain it to anyone else, you're like, it's an anti-slut shaming podcast. That's what it is. It just has a name that's meant to shock you.
Yes.
Out of interest then, so Child Labour, am I right in thinking that's maybe more of a title chosen by Sindhu than yourself?
I remember exactly where we were when we came up with it. I don't remember who came up with it. My guess is that I would have said something like, hey, Sindhu, how about we call it not this, but something like Child Labour, where it has a double meaning. And she'd have gone, that one, or something like that. It was definitely a co-pro. I feel like I would have immediately gone, oh, Christ, we can't call it that. Oh, no, we have to call it that. And then I remember kind of softballing the Radio X people, the global people in the meeting when I kind of said, so we've had some thoughts about the name. Now, obviously, you're not going to let us call it Child Labour, blah, 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 blah. And they kind of stopped and went, oh, no, we like that. And I was like, oh, my God, I think I've just negotiated brilliantly. Or maybe it was just an accident. But it's a lovely name. Although for all her big talk about it, whenever she would introduce it on the show, she always says, welcome to Child Labour, which is about the labour of having a child. You know, like she talked a good game in terms of like, hey, man, if people are offended by that title, then they're idiots and we don't want them in the show. We don't want them in the listenership. And then she would immediately disavow it at the beginning of every year.
Very interesting to me to hear a bit of that behind the scenes, because I think it's probably only slightly exaggerating to say that you have almost entirely opposite forms of parenting. That, like, one example yeah, would be, you know, a child falls over and Sindhu's a bit more, well, they'll learn, and you're a bit more, oh, it must be my fault.
Yeah, that's absolutely fair. It does mean a world of good communicating with Sindhu and hanging out with her and seeing the world from her point of view. We were in Cape Town together before the pandemic hit, and we had some really, it was sort of walking through the streets of Cape Town, which the vibe there is unlike anywhere I've been before. And sort of, I suppose I felt safe with Sindhu because she is, I mean, I'd call her a tough bitch to her face. No, I wouldn't dare. But my point is that, you know, she is a tough lady and she's a tough mum, but very, very loving mum. And I'm sure that she imbues all of her children with strength, whereas my children are, let's hope they don't grow up to be as much of a sort of emotional jellyfish as I am.
That's the thing, though, isn't it? There's no perfect. Like, I think in many ways, particularly the teenager stage, I like to think I'd be quite good at, like, talking about difficult topics. Obviously, like, my background in mental health, if there's any issues there, I'd hopefully be helpful. Certain things like that. However, in reality, it would probably be like, oh, Dad, like, fuck off. Stop asking me how I feel. I want to play Xbox.
I was just going to say, 100%, that is 100% what it would be like. Yes, absolutely. From my still very small, my children are 5 and 2, so I've not been in the game very long as a parent, but certainly you have all these ideas for the kind of parent you're going to be, and you have no idea. You're imagining a thing rather than embodying it. You don't really know how you'll be. And it's like everyone's got a plan. It's like Muhammad Ali once said about parenting. Everyone's got a plan till they get punched in the face. So, you can plan, but also you're only going to be half of the dance partnership mm-hmm. when it comes. So the fact that, for example, my two-year-old, my daughter, doesn't like kisses and doesn't like cuddles. And she says, I don't like kisses, actually. And so I have to press my face on her cheek. But if I make the noise, she goes, oh, it's a kiss. I don't like kisses, actually. So I have to just kind of press my face against hers. I'm like, oh, God, presumably this is a phase, right? And they grow out of this. And my wife keeps saying to me, don't mention it. Don't mention it. Never. Just stop referring to it, because otherwise you're giving her power, because she knows that that reaction of hers makes daddy react in a certain way. So here's me anticipating, like, I'm just like an unlocked door. Emotion flows through me. And yet, you know, who knows whether my kids are going to be like, fine, dad, sure. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And I love that, actually, the finding the humor in it, because I don't think there is a perfect way to parent. I think there's always going to be fallout. And as long as you can do what you can to empower your kids to get some of the help they'll inevitably need, you know, there's always going to be something that you didn't do. And so, you know, if you can do your best and be open to acknowledging the things you might have done wrong, I think that's a good chunk of the battle.
For sure. And it also, you can make big decisions, but most of what they will learn from things that you don't realize you're teaching them. It's almost like you sit down and you go, okay, here we go. Lunchtime on day X. I'm going to teach you now what it means to be a person. And if they could articulate it, they'd be like, you've just spent my entire life teaching me what it means to be a person. Whereas this is one event where you're going to say a thing and you're going to imagine it's like a film and that I'll always remember these words. But of course I'm not. What I'm learning from is how you behave.
For sure. And I do find it funny that your daughter at her young age is already learning that her behaviour might be able to overpower yours.
Yeah, 100%. I am absolutely wrapped around her little finger. I also think one needs to be true to oneself. And I mentioned a wobbly emotional jellyfish earlier on. I can just give them infinite amounts of love, but I don't think I'm going to teach them a certain degree of strength. I would like to, but that would be the sort of teaching where that would be exactly what I mean. It would be like the book learning teaching, like, well, the thing is, you have to be strong. What they're going to learn from me is that it's okay to cry. I'm not going to sit them down and tell them that. They just observe it.
Yeah, really double down on those strengths. I love that. And actually, this is something I'm relating to more than usual during the lockdown and being at home a lot more with my cat. Only yesterday, I found myself sat on the arm of my own sofa because she was already sitting on the sofa. And there was room for me, but I didn't want to disturb her. And I realized I have been too long in her space and there is something going wrong with the hierarchy.
Yes, that's another. I mean, as soon as people start, if you're having a conversation about parenting and people start talking about their nephews or nieces by way of like, I get it, or particularly their pets, naturally, you're like, my instinct, of course, is just to stab you. But having said that, cats are a whole other thing. I don't get cats. And so I completely respect any opinions you have regarding them.
Yes, I'm not saying she's as difficult. I mean, if I tell her off, she runs out of the room. And I think that is something that would not be considered a good thing if it was a child. But for a cat, that is a level of respect that is some people will quite envy. So, yeah, not saying it's the same thing. But before we talk any more about parenting, we should get into dating a little bit. So do you have a story in mind?
Well, here's what I consider to be a story about dating. When I was dating, dating wasn't a thing. I don't know that I've ever dated. I can think of two dates I've been on, both of them probably something like 12 years ago when I briefly experimented with dating apps. Because I am a child of that. I mean, I was born in the 70s. I grew up in the 90s. And we didn't date. What we did was, you know, I would just get drunk at a party, get off with someone, and then 3 years later have to accept that they had to break up with me. I would end up in relationships. And because I am phobic about breaking people's hearts, I'm not saying I'm this big heartbreaker, but I'm phobic about rejecting people, probably because I'm phobic about being rejected myself. As a result, I would never be in situations where I was dating. I feel like I discovered, probably watching Friends in the late 90s, I went, oh, dating is a thing. And I guess it was more of a thing in the States than it was here. And maybe it's kind of traveled over here. But the idea that there were some rules, I'm dating, you know, I'm dating multiple people because we're just dating, but it's not serious. I'm not sleeping with all that kind of stuff. I had no idea there was a system. I had never asked for help. I'd never sought any understanding of it. I was in like a young person's theatre group in my teens, and we would have kind of like after show parties and parties with that group of people. And I was completely sex starved. I was at an all boys school that I hated. And at the weekends, I'd go to this kind of drama group and suddenly there were girls there. And I was quite funny and they seemed to like me rather than completely be disinterested in me. Like I didn't make an impact at school. I was a very boring kid. And suddenly I felt like a kind of sexy superhero. So when I was 14, I snogged someone who was 21 and she was it wasn't a date. It was outside Tesco. And even saying it now, it makes her sound a bit creepy, but it didn't seem like that at the time. I just walked home on air because I was like, oh, I thought I was this loser. But now this woman who I fancy and who is a grown up deigned to kiss me. So suddenly I had this incredible kind of burst of like an unhealthy amount of self-belief. So then I would end up like rather than dating, it was just going to parties and snogging. And it was never in a kind of trying to get notches on a bedpost at all. I think it was probably perceived as that from some people. But I think this is the beginnings, if you like, of a kind of, have you read The Ethical Slut?
Yeah.
You read the book? Okay, so I didn't read that till I was in my 30s. But at the time, I felt like I'd kind of stumbled upon a chapter of it mentally. I was like, oh, there's this thing called kissing and you can do it with people and there's no downside. And you can just snog people and it's great. And so I'd go to parties and I would snog someone and then they'd stop snogging me and then I'd wander off and snog someone else. I wasn't trying to kind of show off to anyone. I wouldn't boast about it. I've never had any kind of male friendships which had a kind of locker room component where you'd be like, I got off with so-and-so. There was nothing celebratory about it. I was just like, this is fun. It's like if I say it's like a massage, that sounds really creepy. But what I mean is it's an inherently sensual experience. You're a person, they're a person. There's this excitement where you realize they're into you and you're into them. And then you snog each other, you get off with each other. And then you go, well, that's that then. Catch you later. And you're like, what a great thing. Everyone benefited. I naively thought as a teenager before I suddenly realized, oh, now if I do want to have a relationship with someone, it's made things quite complicated because now they will know that I've snogged all of my friends and that, oh, God, I haven't thought any of this through. So that typified an awful lot of my adolescence and my approach to physical relationships with people. So I've had two dates and I have nothing to tell you about either of them because they were both disastrous. Meeting someone on the basis of an app, walking in, clocking in the first second that you weren't interested, there's no chemistry, and going, oh Christ, now I've got to sort of get drunk for 3 hours before I build up the courage to say, anyway, this was nice, bye. And so, oh God, I'm so thrilled to be married and to be completely out of the dating game and I never need to go near it again.
You know, I'm hearing that from a lot of the guests that are married, actually. They're
like, really? Oh, that's a good thing. That's nice.
Which is lovely. And then they realise they're talking to me and they're like, oh, it's so horrible. I'm so glad to be out of it. You'll be fine.
I did not even do you that courtesy, an outrage. Like, I do worry. I worry for my children. I don't worry actively for my single friends, but I do get that it's hard. And it's one of those things, like, when you've got kids is all you think about. And you say to your friends, oh, are you thinking about having kids? And then you realise afterwards, someone just kind of nudges you and goes, do you know, that time you asked us 3 years ago if we were trying to have kids, we were desperately trying to have kids, but we couldn't be cool and chat about it. And it's one of those big paradigm shifts where you're like, oh, I'm so busy whinging about how hard my life is now that I completely neglected to take your feelings into account. So I've totally done that to you re-dating. But it just seems to me to be now more so than ever. Well, no, what I was going to say, it seems to be now more so than ever a horrific wasteland. I don't think that. It's certainly maybe the pandemic. But
I'm only teasing you. I think that feels quite accurate from my perspective.
Is it right?
At the moment, yeah. Yeah. Certainly at the moment.
Like, I definitely, when Tinder, it's Tinder, isn't it? Like, that was
so married.
Well, my relationship predates Tinder. Mm-hmm. So I've always said, as soon as Tinder came along, I was already in a committed relationship. And I was like, hang on, you fucking what? You simply couldn't do, what are you going to do? Classified ads? Do you know what I mean? Before there was an app whereby, hey, everyone's playing this game right now. I have been with a now famous TV comic who shall remain nameless when he was like years ago at the Edinburgh Festival, pre-fame, mid on the way up. It was like you'd have a drink with him and he'd just zip off and shag someone and he'd be back 45 minutes later and have another drink and then he'd get another message from someone else. And you'd be like, this is the landscape now. Now, that particular person was very focused and laser guided on I've got to find the one by trying everyone. Like that was their thing. So you're trying to guess who it is, and I won't be admitting it, but unless I've accidentally revealed it by phrasing.
But, oh no, I'm going to have to listen back now.
You're going to have to delete me saying by phrasing.
What was it? They were blonde, huh?
So I remember just recognizing that, going like, oh my God, you what? Probably in the same way that people who lived through Spanish flu would feel about this pandemic. Give it what? You've got the internet now? Do you know what I mean? Like, you're in isolation, in lockdown, but you can talk to whoever you want anywhere in the world. It's a similar sort of shift where you go, I cannot believe that that technology is available. Now, I have got to say, slightly pleasingly, we all recognize that Tinder can become obsessional and compulsive. And there's a comic called Mark Restuccia. He did a show about it, I think, about the fact that he'd become addicted to dating apps. He said, once you get hooked on the dating apps and you're continually perpetuating the idea that someone slightly more perfect could be the next date, you get on all the dating apps and you gradually start recognizing the same faces of the other addicts.
Ooh, yeah, that hits home because I have come across that. And I don't know if this makes me more or less concerning in this case. I've had it where I start noticing people, yes, on more than one app, or they like match with me and then disappear and then match again. And I'm like, what, did they go off and have a relationship and now they're back to match with me and not talk to me? And somehow I think in my head, it feels like I'm gaining power in that situation because I'll message them each time. If I see somebody pop up multiple times, I'll make a thing of messaging them each time to be like, ooh, I wonder if this time they'll reply.
Yes.
Which, depending how you look at it, either is empowered because I'm gamifying their weirdness, or yes, it's desperate because I keep trying people that keep ignoring me. I don't know which one
I'm going with the empowering thing. I'm going with the empowering thing. I think that's interestingly sliced, but I think the first one, definitely.
And it's often I notice people that have a very curated presence. And so that would fit in with the addict idea. You know, their Instagram's linked. They seem to recycle their photos. They're very good photos. They clearly think about their bios. Like, I think a lot of the collecting matches becomes a bit big thing. And it's interesting with the way you described your experience, because when you started off, you said, I've predominantly been in long-term relationships and I didn't really know dating was a thing. And so I was like, oh, so you just weren't playing the market at all. You were just getting straight into long-term after long-term. But by the sounds of it, you were almost like the two extremes of kiss, giggle and skip away versus I'm going to kiss you and we're together forever.
Yeah, I suppose. I suppose the kiss, giggle and skip away was, that's adolescence. You know, that's not like my 20s. Mm-hmm. That was like my kind of entry into the world of relationships, I guess. I went on to have a couple of short girlfriends for like 2 or 3 weeks here and there. And I would also, I basically, because of the 21-year-old from that example, and I should say she was only just 21 and I was like 15 the next week or something. So it's not as creepy. But she, I was really obsessed with, well, I don't know. It was a different time. Porn in hedges as far as the eye could see. A very different time. So I became a bit obsessed with her. We never went out with each other. But then I think that created a pattern for me whereby I would want to be in a relationship with someone, fixate on an idea of a previous person having been the right one, and then have a pretty disastrous relationship with someone where I couldn't get someone else out of my head. I feel terrible saying that, for the distinctly unlikely possibility that one of my few exes will hear this and go, were they talking about me? Am I part of that? Because I'm quite guarded. I'm always expecting to get caught out or found out, or, you know, I've got quite a negative self-image in some way.
I can tell that you're very aware of the words as they come out of your mouth. No, it's interesting. It's like, I don't know if you're thinking too slow for your words or speaking too fast for your thoughts.
Yeah, I have hypervigilance about potential threats. And I think I also have hypervigilance about, that's insane, isn't it? Here I am on a dating podcast, which with all due respect to it, isn't the Oprah of, it's not Oprah. So the likelihood of, hey, listen, I'm not slamming your podcast, man, but, you know, it's very unlikely that an actress I went out with 25 years ago will hear this and be personally offended. But I absolutely do operate as if that's the case, because I'm worried and I, you know, that's the thing I'm working through at the minute. Anyway, my point is that I replicated that template, I think, over and over again, of being with someone, feeling it wasn't right, breaking up with them or being broken up with, and then the next person I would be with, I would have in the back of my mind that the previous person, that was the one. And that is just an enormously pointless and time-wasting and upsetting template to have. And that's one of the things I'm thrilled to be out of now. I think I always had a problem of possibility. What do I want to do? I could do this, I could do that, I could be anyone, I could be with anyone, I could be anything. The whole world is there for me. I'm such a mediocre white man. And it's all in front of me. So deciding opening one door means closing 20 others. And I found that really, really difficult. So I was in long-term relationships, almost invariably with small redheads with the middle name Francis.
That's very specific, but
I mean, I really got a type.
It's interesting, though, the way you've articulated that, because I think it's so true to the dating app experience. Oh. That gamification of them really creates this idea that the perfect person could be a few more swipes away. And then also it plays in very well if you're someone that struggles with vulnerability in a relationship. You being somewhat, you know, one foot in a past relationship is a way to protect yourself. And then if it all falls to shit, it's like, oh, well, they probably weren't as good as my ex anyway.
Certainly, I will absolutely cop to any accusations of cowardice, self-preservation, cravenness. I'm sure they're all correct, absolutely. I think gamification is an important word, though, because I think from what little I know of the dating apps, they absolutely... I mean, I've joined Twitch during the pandemic, and Twitch gamifies the user experience. It also gamifies the creator experience. So as I don't know if you're on Twitch, but as a Twitch creator, in inverted commas, when I was on it loads last year, I would constantly get updates telling me that X number of people watched your last stream. You just need to go up to X plus 30% number of people to hit this badge and achievement. And they just turned it into a computer game. So I try and be aware of things like that. It was pre-Tinder. So the two internet dates I went on were probably both through OkCupid, which you don't really hear anyone talking about anymore. It wasn't an app. It was a site. From what I remember of that, it was definitely set up to perpetuate itself. Because if you think of the business model, if you run Tinder, your end game is not that everyone be coupled up and happy, because then your product disappears. So your end game, really the best situation, if you're the person that runs, say, Tinder, and I'm aware of how dated that sounds already, Bumble. Is Bumble the new one? Is that the one for people in the arts? Anyway, literally, I don't care. But if I say Bumble's the new one, you're looking at me like, Bumble closed 5 years ago.
Bumble's not that new.
But if you ran one of those apps, your best case scenario would be that customer A goes on date after date after date after date. So surely there is something weird and creepy they're doing as a result of kind of data-driven analysis, whereby they're making sure that you don't fall in love, aren't they?
And the crazy thing of it is, I think in our modern day, it's very easy for people to think that that's their fault, because social media 100%. Is such a big part of our lives. And like one example you've reminded me of is the ones that really pioneered the constant scrolling or swiping were Pinterest. Like if you look at their setup, it's very basic. But the key thing that makes Pinterest so addictive is there's just a never-ending ability to scroll. And before that, other places weren't doing it. On Facebook, you had to press show more. And they found that as soon as they removed that and you could just scroll and scroll, people would, because they're like, oh, well, maybe the next thing, maybe a few more clicks down and there'll be something. Yeah. And then it builds these behaviors. But because it's so normalized in our lives, we can't blame this thing. Do you know what I mean? It'd be like, I'm trying to think of another comparison. It's kind of like how people feel more scared of flights than they do of cars. And yet cars are so much more dangerous when you look at the stats. But the cars are the things you see every day. So it's very difficult to think, okay, that's a scary thing that's there constantly.
Yes, I would agree. Or like, just to come back to the Facebook example, that kind of infinite scrolling thing, they probably nicked that off porn, didn't they? The idea that, you know, as a younger man...
Well, they nicked it off Pinterest, but maybe...
Well, I wouldn't release a press release saying I'd nicked it off porn. But, you know, as a younger gentleman, I'm sure I've seen a hell of a lot of porn. And it perpetuates a need it can never fulfill, right? And it's like the next thing, somewhere like this image is attractive to me and arousing in some sort of way, but an even better one might be just around the corner. So, yeah.
Heaven.
I don't know. I think that's the end of my point. You better pop a sting in there, mate. That's what I'd do.
You know what? I'm meant to give you points in this show. I've been so engrossed in the conversation, I haven't yet. So you get some points. We'll catch up.
Oh, is that for the sake of it being the dating game podcast? Do we need to... We gamified it. You
thank you for understanding. You gamified it. How we're stretching the metaphor. Yes.
Here we are pontificating about gamification whilst you award me points. This is insane.
God, it's so meta. Yeah, so points will be edited in after the interview.
Do you do a loot crate thing as well, whereby at the end of one anecdote, you might offer me some, a random amount, or 0 points just to keep me hooked? Gotta keep giving Bobby content.
I just try and leave it up to my producer because the points ultimately don't mean much, but they really entertain me. And so he does different numbers of points randomly and then it entertains me in the end.
Well, lovely. Might I suggest to your unnamed producer, hello, unnamed producer, I would suggest...
His name's Pete. It's not a secret.
Hey, Pete. Pete, I would suggest my points so far be like a sort of rising upward curve where I really start smashing it. And then on that bit a moment ago where I said, so yeah, you dock me all of my existing points and I go back to zero. That would be a thrill ride.
That sound effect like do-do-do-do-do-do. Okay, interesting. You're such a podcaster. We're making a new show in real time.
I'm sorry, mate. I do this to everyone.
So where were we up to? You've given me a lot of information to think about. So the thing you got me wondering about really was where you would be at if you were doing dating apps now. And I wonder if you might be one of the people that's like collecting and getting something out of that. Or
I would have deleted them by now.
You think?
Yeah, I think I'd have gone for it, gone way too hard and become deeply unhappy and then needed to make a change in my life, possibly an intervention from some friends, and then I would have deleted them all. I've got way too addictive a personality to be getting in. I would absolutely have the horrors and bail out. I'm sure I would. Would I? I don't know. That's, to be honest, I am treating it, I suppose, disrespectfully to people who still use it.
Because I mean, it's difficult to say, isn't it? Because you could say that, but then equally you could say, no, actually, I could do the same pattern. I could go on loads of dates and sit there with my phone full of other options and half commit to those dates. And you're very glad to be married. And it sounds like a fun relationship where you balance each other out quite well.
My relationship with my wife, I never talk about it. I talk about it on stage and I think sometimes she feels like I just get on stage and let fly and have a big go at her. I don't see it that way at all, but then she is not a comedian. And so I never need to worry about her getting on stage and having a go at me. I think that there are lots of ways in which we clash, really. I think there are lots of... The thing I always think is that if you gave both of us the same job to clean a house, she'd clean it from top to bottom and I'd clean it from bottom to top. And if we met each other halfway, we'd be furious with the other. We'd be just like... I think a lot of our basic instincts for how a thing should be done are completely contradictory. Also, in her defence, she is absolutely brilliant at organisation, structure, planning, all the rest of those things. I think I am, but actually I am scatterbrained and I'm just not a project manager. The best thing I offered on the morning of our wedding, I had a walkie-talkie and all the planning had been done predominantly by her. I had been present and had contributed, but often my contributions were not as good as the things she'd already contributed. So even the previous night, we had like a 3-day wedding festival because we're those guys. So we got in the previous night and all the helpers, we had a dedicated team of 20 of our mates who were all going to camp over 2 or 3 nights. And then the wedding party got there and did the one day. So I had a walkie-talkie and I was organising things and co-masterminding rehearsals with our friend Jay, who was like our official organiser. So I'm good in the moment and I'm good when there's a crisis. But when there isn't a crisis, I get all wobbly and all over the place. And I think my view of my relationship with my wife is that I benefit from it enormously. I honestly don't know what she gets out of it.
You know what? Interestingly, Hal Cruttendon has a very similar take on his marriage, where he's like, I know why I'm there. I sometimes wonder why she is.
Yeah, I know Hal, and I see his point. I don't mean that. Yeah, I think my wife is just, what does she get out of it? I suppose maybe it's quite exciting to be around someone as flappy as me. I don't think so. I do wonder, the more she's got, I think what it is.
Your stress is just entertainment to her, is that what you're saying?
Well, no, I think she likes a fixer-upper. I think she probably regards me as a project. And she's a very giving and healing and patient kind of person. So I feel like maybe what she gets out of it is the idea that one day I'll be finished.
Interesting. And you said off air to me that how you met was at Glastonbury and she hadn't seen your stand-up before expressing an interest in you. And so I would say maybe a bit of a risk taker on who she's looking to fix her up.
Well, yes, she. It's funny, actually. I met her when I was at Glastonbury with my friend Bennett. And then Bennett started hitting on her as hard as he possibly could. And then months later, he rang me from her house where he'd like gone to Bristol to hang out with her and I guess chance his arm and had been rebuffed. And he rang me from her garden and said, well, this is a difficult phone call to make. She prefers you. And I was like, hey! so it all kind of worked. Bless Bennett. Dear sweet Bennett.
Did you ever get the behind the scenes on that? Like, was he prompted to make that phone call?
Do you know, I don't think I ever asked. I probably just didn't pry. For everybody's sake. So we met at Glastonbury and then she came to see me do, and it wasn't even stand-up. She saw me do a street show first because that was in the dovetailing bit of former street performer, became a comedian like 15 years ago now, but street performing is a big part of my internal landscape because I talk about it all the time. And I would have quit being a street performer years ago and got the gear out of the case every Glastonbury just because it's fun to do and it's the easiest street gig in the world. You just cough and 300 people go, yeah, what? And then you do a show. It's wonderful. So she would have seen me do that. And I think I remember her saying, actually, I don't know whether this particularly impressed her, but I do remember the show that she saw, that I had a child volunteer on stage and the child wet themselves. And I dealt with it in a really compassionate way and noticed, didn't draw attention to it, got the kid back in the audience and replaced them and stuff and made a joke about something else, kind of misdirection. And I wonder, I suppose my notion is that she thought, ah, this guy's a good egg. So I paid the kid off. So that was that's how we met. And as a result, festivals and Glastonbury have been a big thing. She was there. She used to. And still does when the festival is back, which it will be, I'm absolutely confident. She worked in the kids' field and she does fun, creative stuff with children in the kids' field. That was her way into Glastonbury for years. And as I was, you know, so we'd been multiple times not knowing each other. And I just really, like, she's just creative and funny and silly and giving and an ocean of patience and calm and just seems to be able to tolerate all of my fucking emotional yo-yo roller coaster bullshit. You know, I'm a very lucky man. I don't know what she is. I don't know. It's like, I don't feel like I've hoodwinked her into anything. I'm certain that she is here entirely of her own volition, but I do not know why.
No, I think that's lovely. I feel like we're going to break the format again, and I think she deserves some points.
Yes. Oh, good. She'll be pleased because at the moment she's got both kids and it's been a long day. So it's been a long day for her. I've been up here doing admin and podcasts. Yes, I will pop down. How many points are we awarding my wife, please?
I don't know. Pete, 3. Can we do that?
3? Okay, I'll lie to her. That's fine. I love that. I love this stuff.
What, 3,000? I don't think the podcast is long enough for 3,000. Could you imagine?
Okay, 3 points.
And now we're going to devote an hour to Stuart's wife.
Oh, yeah. I don't know how your point system works, you see. I didn't know whether we were scoring in hundreds or what have you.
Sorry, listeners. This is what happens when I don't fully explain the concept before starting the interview. So, no, but I can, you know what? Even you telling me about her, I can kind of tell, like, the calm that she brings you. It comes across.
Yeah, man.
And that is very cool.
Like, the funny thing is, like, she isn't a performer because she's better than that. Do you know what I mean? Like, she has no need to entertain people. She's got no yawning chasm within her, you know, there's shorthand here. But I think most comics are trying to run away from something or run towards something. And she just isn't. But she is a brilliantly gifted natural impressionist. She's genuinely, she can hear someone go, oh, they're a bit like that, aren't they? And then just do them. And I keep trying to get her into, hey, mate, let's come on, it's the lockdown. Let's get you a voice reel. Let's try and hook you up with an agent. And she's like, yeah, I don't know. I'd have to go to London, wouldn't I? Or whatever. You know? And I'm like, do you know what? I don't want to break this.
And I wonder if that's part of how it all makes sense, that you go and do that and she's very entertained by it, but she doesn't really want to do it herself.
Yeah, I think so.
Because my flatmate's a bit like that. She's like, I love that you do the public-facing stuff. She accuses me of stealing all her best lines. We can debate about whether or not that's true. But I think part of her is like, well, I'd rather you go out and say it in the world than I have to be assigned to those things.
Yes, totally. Well, obviously it's been a couple of years since an Edinburgh show, but there was a running joke for 2 or 3 years whereby Josh Widdicombe, and I'm name dropping because it's important to the story, he would see my show and then he would guess, like at the Edinburgh Festival, each year he'd see my show and he would guess which line, which joke or observation was written by my wife. Mm-hmm. And he always got it right because they were always the best jokes. There was like the purest observation. I had, and this will date it, what, 20, God, it must be 2015. The best joke in the show was about how...
I'm just laughing to myself because this will very much feed well into my flatmate's narrative. Like, ooh, what's that? All the best bits don't come from them.
Yeah, totally. What I loved was the fact that Josh, who, as we know, is an incredibly gifted and natural observationalist, mm-hmm. he could tell the best bits because I was passing... Each show, there would be at least one bit which I'd be passing off as my own observation. And her particular one was that from that particular show... was that Costa Coffee kept opening little branches of Costa in other buildings and institutions. And that was a thing that was unique to them. I mean, it's a bit more common now. But so there was a whole bit about how Starbucks are losing in the kind of Game of Thrones monarchy challenge of who wins coffee. Costa are winning because they've got this tactic of building little branches of Costa Coffee inside other buildings. I was in a Starbucks the other day. It's a tiny little Costa. You know, stuff like that. So I'd text Josh after the show and go, could you tell which one was her joke? And he'd text back Costa. And I'd be like, yes! And he'd say, I think at the time he said, McIntyre. Entire levels of brilliance. You know. Aww. So she's very pleased, I think, to take none of the performative risk. There's mm-hmm. no deal, there's no anxiety cost, anxiety debt or any of those things. She just gets to go, that's my little perfect thing, and then hand it over. She also did an impression of the sun setting and an impression of food in the fridge when you open the door, and I absolutely lifted both of those wholesale, but credited them at the time.
I love that. I think this relationship sounds delightful. And we will start wrapping up now. So do you have something from this relationship or just your experience in general that you try and live by?
A relationship rule of the game. Mm-hmm. Smells like format to me. I am right now, this month, getting into the concept of self-compassion. I've been really bad at that. And I've always tried to have compassion for other people, but I've always been desperately self-involved. And I think the root of that self-involvement is fearing that I'm always in the wrong. And so I am trying to actively practice self-compassion. I'm finding it very difficult. And it's very easy to call yourself a wanker for even trying. It can be a really self-defeating thing. So my rule of the game is practice self-compassion, and that will make you more honestly compassionate to other people. Because I think I would not have wasted the time of some of the people I was with when I knew it was wrong. And that boils down to a sort of deep-seated fear in me, whereby I didn't kind of back myself enough. I didn't trust my instincts enough and think, if this feels wrong, it's probably wrong. But I was so desperately scared of being alone that I would tamp that down and go, oh, I can make it work. And I don't think it's, you know, I'll leave it to producer Pete to boil that down into a sentence by cutting out every fifth and sixth word.
No, I love it. You said all of that. And I was like, who's the credit for this one? RuPaul at the end of every Drag Race episode? But no, you make a really good point. And it is so difficult. It's so common that we're much better at loving other people and seeing their strengths than we are with ourselves. And perhaps no more intensely than right down in a lockdown, where we're stuck with a lot of ourselves and we're like, God, I'm bored of you. Where are the other people?
Yeah, true enough. That thing about RuPaul as well, me and my wife agree on this. We've never understood why Ru says at the end of each episode, if you don't love yourself, how the hell are you going to love somebody else? That always seems the wrong way around to me. Like, that sort of puts the goal of loving someone else above loving yourself, doesn't it?
Oh, interesting. Interesting. That so often we do prioritize making ourselves good for other people. And that's part of why we can get so critical. Yeah.
You should love yourself anyway. And remember, just actually love yourself. The end. Now let the music play.
And then the one I thought of while we were saying all of that was about when choosing people to be with. I've definitely fallen foul to the trap of getting into a relationship because of the differences between me and that person being more novelty as opposed to a good idea. And I think might be something maybe we've got a little bit of root similarity in, of like sometimes struggling with vulnerability. And it's like, sometimes I'll take the fun but risky option because, well, if it doesn't work out, it was the fun but risky option. And then the option that actually makes more sense to me, that's a level of commitment and vulnerability that's a bit more scary.
Maybe, but I think Sindhu would say that your psychic self is looking out for you and you should trust your instincts. If you want to go with the fun but scary one, maybe you want some fun. And that's something I remember Sindhu saying to me, was like, this, the previous relationship to the one that is my now my marriage, was a really an incredibly deep and meaningful and positive and powerful relationship for me. And it's only really, like, it was a long time after it before I could kind of, I'm not going to say honour it, because I'm from Leamington Spa. You know, mediocre white men from Leamington don't talk like that, in all honesty. But to kind of really respect it for what it was, Sindhu told me that, you see, when you thought you kind of broke everything apart and ruined everything and were sort of depressed for years afterwards, actually your psychic self was protecting you because you knew you didn't want what that was giving you ultimately. So that's, you know, that's the sort of thing Sindhu would say. But that is all part and parcel of her incredible resilience and groundedness.
I'm so looking forward to interviewing her. It's going to be an experience. But yeah, for now, I guess that's what I've got. That's my best attempt at a rule of the game this week, is try to date people that are different to you in more of a purposeful rather than novelty way. And yeah, hopefully by doing so, I can protect my psychic self or otherwise. I don't know. We'll find out. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me. It's been really great. What kind of stuff have you got coming up that you might want to plug?
Well, the pivot that I did last year, where I started doing online chat shows and stuff, has kind of metamorphosed or has kind of coalesced into two things. Basically, you can find out all about them at stuartgoldsmith.co.uk, because now I do lots of business speaking and I take the combined wisdom of all of the 350 plus comics I've had on my Comedians Comedian podcast. And I've sort of distilled kind of not exactly rules for life, but principles about resilience, and especially resilience in pandemic. And now I speak to businesses about that. So if anyone's listening and runs a business or has a business or can get me in with a business, I would love you to check out stuartgoldsmith.co.uk, because it's become weirdly a passion. And I think at the beginning of the pandemic, I was thinking, you know, obviously the circuit imploded. Where a comedian is going to work? I thought, God, I wonder who's going to survive this as a comedian, who's going to end up doing something else. And I'm like, although I've absolutely survived as a comedian, I've really passionate. I've like discovered a whole other thing I can do, and it feels pretty exciting.
And so, I love that's a really articulate way of you explaining why it's so great from your perspective, whereas I hear that as someone with a business background and I'm like, he can run an AGM for me and it be funny and people not be bored and I can sit down and laugh. That's why I would buy it. So yeah. Great service.
I can 100% do that. So there's that. And then my own podcast is, everything you need is at comedianscomedian.com.
Brilliant. All right. Well, thanks again.
Cheers, buddy. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening. For more content, including extended ad-free episodes, you can join our Patreon, linked in the episode description. Our show is edited and produced by Pete Murta, with music by the brilliant Tessa Violet. Speak to you next Friday.